Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth and Movies. I'm Layla Latif.
I'm Leslie Pitt.
And I'm Steph Green.
On the show this week, hedge fund offices prove the worst place to fall in love in Fair Play. 50 years on from the original, the devil still makes little girls his playground in Exorcist Believer. And on Film Club, women in the workplace may be sexy, but they sure are bad at their jobs in Disclosure. All coming up in Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. So, Leslie, it's been a while. Last had you on for Grey Man and Where the Crawdads Sing. That was a fun day that we had. A lot has changed. You've had a baby. A lot of exciting things have happened. But work-wise, what have you been up to?
Work-wise, I've kind of, since having a baby, I don't think I've been doing as much of anything as I used to. I think I've just been kind of trying to find something to write about and doing the erotic thriller podcast, doing Fatal Attractions when I can, writing for Set the Tape when I can or anything. But in terms of like actual work, I haven't been at it as much as I have been in the past. You know, you've got a third person to look after now, so therefore they just don't have the chance.
And then it turns out when you pitch publications being just like, has anybody made a film about how working parenthood is hard? You're not the first person that's had that thought.
No. I mean, I turned around to David Jenkins the other day and kind of semi sort of said, I've got this idea. It's kind of a pitch. It's kind of a personal essay. But it was all the same kind of, look, I'm a dad and I've got a kid and movies and just a mesh of stuff. And I think it's far too personal an essay. So I think I might just blog it and see where it goes from there as opposed to any sort of pitching to anybody.
Well, yeah, I mean, with these like very personal things, sometimes it is difficult to put them out into the world. But I mean, I hope you write it. I'm going to look forward to reading it.
Oh, yeah, we'll see.
And Steph, you have been writing for Little White Lies, I think, like two years at least now. But it's your first time on the podcast, which is very exciting.
Yeah, very excited to be on the pod. And I think all those hours I've spent watching terrible erotic thrillers on a Saturday night while beautiful people make love to saxophone soundtracks has been worth it, so because I've been invited onto this episode, so I'm very happy about it.
But I remember talking to you once about like your path into film criticism. It was because you started out just being very into French cinema, is that right? And then you just sort of spiraled.
Yeah, I mean, I studied French at university and did, you know, a course in French film and then did another course in French film and got very into it. So I think it's, you know, very lame to be like, ah, yes, the Nouvelle Vague got me in to the big screen. But it really did, you know, 400 Blows, still one of my favourite films. I don't really know how I got from the 400 Blows to erotic thrillers. So I might need to, you know, work that out somehow. But yeah, I kind of went from there, started writing, you know, for my own blog. And it just slowly, you know, over the past 5-6 years developed from there.
I mean, like, Leslie, you've obviously got a podcast and you guys do screenings, all kind of related to the erotic theatre. But can you guys think of, like, what your kind of, what was the first one that you saw that kind of most made you think, like, this is a genre I want to dive into?
Wild Things. It had to be Wild Things.
Oh, my. I love how many twists there are in Wild Things. There's, like, 17 in a row.
I mean, the thing I like about it is not just the twist, it's the fact that the twists work. It's the film that I would recommend to most people if they were going to try, like, in terms of accessibility to this whole idea, because it's just so, it doesn't take itself seriously and it's kind of big and large and just ridiculous. But it knows it's ridiculous, and directed by the director of Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer as well. There was an element of things that I like in there. So I kind of got into film via horror films when I was younger. So finding out that this guy did this, I was like, okay, well, I'll give it a go. And it was the most surreal thing I've ever seen. And Bill Murray and crocodiles and swamp marsh and all sorts. It's just, there was something about that and the kind of soap opera stars in it and everything about it that just screams to me that more people need to watch it, even though it's actually quite popular. So that's the one I would kind of bring up as a film to for anyone to watch.
I remember watching that film and not even really knowing anything about how, like, acting worked, understood that, like, oh, I can see a series of nudity clauses where this person has clearly agreed to side and this back, this front, this one's gone full frontal. But it, you know, it's like so clearly, precisely choreographed based on what was in a contract.
It's like the Expendables of of erotic thrillers in that way, where clearly people have just turned around and said, well, I don't want to be doing this, and I don't want to be doing this, or I've done something like this before, so therefore, you know, it all kind of plays out in that one very, very memorable scene.
Memorable indeed. Steph, what about you? What was your sort of intro into this sort of crazy, thrilling, erotic world?
Gosh, I can't really remember what my first one would have been, but I think the strongest memory, maybe one of the very first ones I watched, was Brandon Palmer's Body Double. And I just, you know, maybe that is the link. Maybe I sort of started to watch some Hitchcock, and then I saw lots of people saying, oh, if you like Hitchcock, watch this crazy guy's films. Maybe that's how the trajectory happened from sort of classic cinema to this. You know, it was beautifully made. There were split screens. These beautiful women are dancing. The drill, the Pino Donaggio score, the way that the film just becomes another different film halfway through. There was so much happening, and it was so ridiculous, but so beautifully made. And I think it just really, like, typified the whole genre for me, how it can be ludicrous and improbable. And I don't know, I hate the word problematic, but let's throw that in there. But it can still be this really interesting commentary on sex and desire and men and women and the society that envelops them. And I just think maybe from there, maybe I peaked too early because the rest are not as good as that film. But yeah, I think it was Body Double.
I think you need that problematic aspect in these films. I find it quite sad and tragic that we're so kind of whitewashing so much of this stuff because it might offend someone, or it might feel wrong or anything else or anything about it, instead of actually putting something in there that will get people talking. I think we might kind of lean on this later on in a lot of the films that we're talking about today. But I think if it wasn't for someone like De Palma making these things problematic, I think by him doing certain things, he makes it easier for us, people like us, to talk about these sort of things, as opposed to this kind of self-censorship and puritanical way of dealing with stuff now, where it's like, no, we can't say this, we can't do that, we can't do this, we can't show this. I think it's quite interesting to have an element of something problematic in there. I remember we did Pacific Heights on the podcast, and I really didn't like Matthew Modine's character.
Is that the one with the tenant from hell?
Yes. Right. So it's Tenant from Hell, and there's something about these yuppies in distress mm-hmm. thing that was already kind of annoying, but there's this kind of underlying bigotry that Matthew Modine's character has all the way through the film. Mm-hmm. And it really got my back up. And I remember just being really, really frustrated with him. But then I realised that's actually a really good performance. And it gives you something there. It gives you a bit of an edge. It gives him an interesting character. Otherwise, he'd be very boring and bland. And I think he really kind of grasps onto something and gives you something to pull apart and extrapolate, and you kind of side, you're supposed to be siding with him, but you're not completely sympathetic, and that really, really got me engaged into the movie. And I wonder if how I would feel about watching it again, especially after watching Modine in, like, lots of Nolan films and stuff like that, and seeing what he's like and seeing his body of work. I find that you kind of need that thing. It's just, maybe it's something that an actor can have a hook on or something else like that. But I find that part of it sometimes really interesting to have in these type of movies.
I completely agree. And I think when a lot of contemporary filmmakers try and be edgy in a like triggered much kind of way, it kind of falls flat. And then when you look back at these films, yes, they're pushing boundaries, but they're always in a way that is trying to kind of pull out that nugget of truth in a situation between in gender roles. And I think that's why it works in a way, in the way that it does.
Oscar Wilde attended a lynching, so I'm not going to entirely say that he was right on every count. But I always think of his quote of like, everything in the world is about sex except for sex, which is about power.
I think we're going to get onto that later, yeah. Isn't it, really? But yeah, I think there is an element of that in there. I always find it quite interesting. You know, we started with Basic Instinct and Fatal Attractions, and there is this element of, especially in Basic Instinct, there is this element of power. And I've always said it when I've written about Basic Instinct, when I talked about it on the podcast. I think the best thing about Basic Instinct is Sharon Stone being the smartest person in the room at all points, at all times. And then you kind of look at the making of and her kind of complex feelings about making the film, how she felt about Verhoeven and some of the things he did in order to get what he wanted to get out of it and everything. But then she also turns around and says, well, I look at the box office and I think we did okay. And it's just this kind of really interesting kind of dichotomy and contrast of her turning around going, I did use my sexuality in here and I got something out of it, but also at what cost?
Well, I think consent of what happened on screen comes in as an issue for her. From what I understand of Sharon Stone, she did not believe that upskirt shot was going to be used.
Yeah.
Which I think is a different... and then obviously, I guess that's one of the issues of gender within this, where it's just like nobody was like considering Michael Douglas as not being able to kind of do a wide range of roles. I mean, I think he's got 2 Oscars and stuff. And, you know, Sharon Stone has spoken a lot about how she was, really typecast and not considered to be like a proper actress after being in the same film.
I always find it so difficult because I think it is still her best role. There's this element of Verhoeven doing that repeatedly, obviously in Showgirls as well. And I think he really borders on something where he kind of he's on the edge of something with Elizabeth Berkley and Sharon Stone, but then afterwards they can't really do anything ever again. And it's really sad because you kind of see in there that I think he gets something out of them and he gets something out of the kind of sexuality that they can both bring. But also I always still feel that it's at a cost.
Well, it's an erotic thriller conundrum, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to be too kind of, because obviously I'm the bloke in this, but it's just like, I find that aspect of it fascinating all the time. It's one of the reasons why I think we now have a look at stuff like intimacy coordinators, so we can kind of still extrapolate those kind of powerful performances, but also keep other aspects of stuff in check as well. But I don't know. I don't make films, so...
Well, no, it's Michaela Cole's thing of, like, you can, you know, you reenact traumatic events without being traumatized yourself. Isn't that a wonderful thing? Steph, what about you? I mean, obviously this, you know, as a sort of genre, but also just, like, eroticism exists outside of, you know, the Hollywood 80s and 90s era. How do you feel like it's evolved? We obviously had, like, you know, the pre-Hays Code, post-Hays Code, but then... You know, Europe being a lot more willing to be erotic. And now it feels like a bit more puritanical. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, I won't rehash the conversation that we all keep having about sex disappearing off the screen. And I should really clarify that sex is disappearing off the big screen, but not necessarily the small. You know, sex is thriving on television in many ways, but it's definitely falling off of the big screen. But talking about erotic thrillers specifically, they sort of died a slow death as we edged towards the millennium. And then films from the early noughties, we had Adrian Lyne's Unfaithful, which was wildly successful. Diane Lane got an Oscar nomination, which is very rare for an erotic thriller. But then after that, you've got the things like Meg Ryan in The Cut was absolutely lambasted to the high heavens for her performance. And that was
so good.
It's such a good performance. It's one of my favourite films. But, you know, that there's interviews where she's, you know, kind of being told off for shedding her images of America's sweetheart. And, you know, from then, there's not really been many films unless, like you say, coming out of Europe, there are some great European erotic thrillers of recent times. There's Stranger by the Lake, which is an amazing French erotic thriller. There's another French erotic thriller starring Vanessa Paradis, set in the world of gay porn in the 80s. I don't know if you guys remember the name because it's escaped me, but there's lots of, you know, incredible films like that. Unfortunately, attempts to revive the genre haven't been very successful. You've got Adrian Lyne's Deep Water, which I didn't think was terrible, but it certainly made absolutely no cultural imprint whatsoever, despite the whole Ben Affleck, Ana de Armas of it all. There is still, you know, The Voyeurs is a really good erotic thriller. I'm not sure how much of an impact it had, but it was, you know, a successful, sexy film that was made safely, you know, all actors feeling safe, but still being very sexy with a great, fun, thrilling plot. It can happen, but it was a genre that really ruled the roost in the 90s. You know, it was one of the most lucrative films that filmmakers could make. It was number one on the VHS sales and rentals. I mean, I'm sure you can figure out why. I really hope those VHSs were, you know, cleaned up before they were returned.
Oh. Yeah, you say Be Kind Rewind on my local video one. So it's like Be Kind Rewind, and also Please Give a Wipe.
Yes, Kina. You know, they are not as popular and lucrative as they used to be. But, you know, we can live in hope that they are reborn. But
I kind of almost disagree. And the reason why I disagree is because you have 365 days, which is a series of movies, but become very, very popular on Netflix nearly every time they kind of got released. Then you had, well, before then, you had 50 Shades of Grey, which became a popular series of movies. They did make money. They did make bank.
They made money, Leslie, but we're talking about Fatal Attraction being like the number one global blockbuster of the year.
I think $300 million.
But I think we've kind of moved now towards studios turning around and believing that adults aren't the people that actually pay for movie tickets, it's children. That's why we have everything that we have here. We've had a kind of, not dumbing down, but a kind of arrested development for the last 15 years of just constant franchise movies and people arguing about Star Wars and seeing these movies get kind of topics shoehorned into them. But then everyone gets really upset and goes, oh, my, I don't want any politics in my space operas or what have you.
But that's my Twitter bio. I don't want any politics in my space operas.
But I think, you know, that's a big, big aspect of it. I think 20 odd years ago, I remember being working at a cinema when In the Cut came out, and it didn't make that much money, yes. But at least it had a screen, if not two screens, and it had people going in to watch it. Nowadays, that mid-budget film has gone. And because a mid-budget film has gone, therefore, you can't really make anything that kind of has that lasting imprint, I don't think. Or it's gone to streaming or whatnot. So I think it can be done. And yeah, I don't think 50 Shades had as much as an impact, but I think it did have an impact. I think it did turn around and say, look, we're still here. I don't think the money it made was not to be, it wasn't anything to be kind of sniffed at.
I just think, you know, we need to live by the rule where if you want filth, you go to France. you've got directors like François Ozon doing Double Lover, Swimming Pool. You've got Elle, you know, yeah, Paul Verhoeven's Elle. You know, Knife and Heart is the name of the film that I forgot earlier with Vanessa Paradis. So I think we've just got to hop in a plane to France, guys.
Yes. What was it that Bong Joon-ho said of, like, if you can overcome the hurdle of the
one-inch barrier.
The one-inch barrier subtitles.
Then there's so many sexy thrills ahead.
Exactly.
But not even with a one-inch barrier of subtitles ahead, we should get into the first movie of the week. It's Chloe Dormant's Fair Play.
Join our community of film lovers by becoming a Little White Lies member. We receive exclusive perks and an insider's view into the world of Little White Lies while directly supporting our independent film journalism. Search Little White Lies membership via your search engine and click through to our SETI HQ page for a detailed breakdown of the plans. Now on to the movies.
Uh, An unexpected promotion at a cutthroat hedge fund firm pushes a newly engaged couple's relationship to the brink. So Steph, I mean, this was labelled an erotic thriller. It was like one of the buzziest titles out of Sundance, which was like in January of this year. Would you classify this as an erotic thriller? Was it erotic? Was it thrilling?
Well, I think in order to answer your question, I need to kind of break down, you know, what is an erotic thriller? And it's a really tough question. And lots of people have, you know, different ideas on how to define it. I think, you know, some people say it needs to have a thematic basis in illicit romance or erotic fantasy. With the characters in this film, you've got Emily and Luke, played by Phoebe Dynevor and Alden Ehrenreich. And I think, you know, they're not meant to be together because they're colleagues and that's against the rules of their company. Is this basis for, you know, a real illicit romance? I don't know. You know, if they get found out, they maybe would need to get a new job. I don't know if the stakes are that high for it to be, you know, a real sense of...
They're also earning so much money. Like, it's like it's not like nobody's going to...
I think, you know, they'll be able to get another job. And then, you know, the idea of danger and pleasure being in close proximity, sort of, you know, there's a scene, which I'm sure we'll talk about later on in the film, where Emily is put in a position of sexual danger by her partner. Is she feeling pleasure at that moment? I'm not sure. And then you've also got the stock characters of an erotic thriller, the femme fatale, the homme fatale, which you also have. Are those stock characters present in this film? I'm not too sure. Is there a fool guy? I'm not sure he quite qualifies, the male lead. And then also, when you look at an erotic thriller, you think about the style, you think about those noirish elements. And the way that this film is shot, I think, is maybe lacking in that kind of flair that we would come to expect or associate with an erotic thriller. So I think I would come to the conclusion that just because there's a few sex scenes, does that make a film erotic? I would maybe push back against that. So for me, no, I'm not sure I would call it an erotic thriller. I think it's fairly successful as a sort of workplace drama, but it wouldn't quite fit into that category for me.
I mean, it does seem that like the kind of the, I suppose like the Hollywood heyday of the erotic thriller was like born out of this sort of fear of like the rise of third wave feminism and of, you know, the AIDS crisis of, you know, kind of women's sexual freedom. So women entering the workplace in so many ways. And like, those were the anxieties, a lot of those basic instinct, disclosure, fatal attraction, kind of building on like the fear of the sort of liberated working woman. Do you think in some ways this is like in conversation with that?
Absolutely, I think it is. I think it's the way that the filmmakers treat those themes that has changed. As you said, you know, a lot of films from the 80s and 90s were a lot to do with fear of AIDS or fear of a threat to the nuclear family. And that's, you know, very clearly present in films like Fatal Attraction. But it was done in such an implausible way. The bunny boiler, the ice pick, you know, those films are designed to be sat hooting and hollering at what's happening on screen. And I think Fair Play is a film that is very much in conversation with anxieties we're having between, for want of a better phrase, battle of the sexes now. But it's much more nuanced, it's much more realistic. I think everything that happens in Fair Play is well within the realm of possibility. Maybe it's not quite as fun for that reason, because it's done in such a nuanced way. But, you know, that it is still very much a genre that is in conversation with those themes, and Fair Play definitely is a film that does that.
I mean, there's the, as our resident representation of the male population.
Oh, God. Go on.
How did you kind of view the gender dynamic between them? Because I watched this in Sundance and I remember seeing a lot of reactions online that were just like, they're both as bad as each other. And that's not the movie I watched. So I was wondering, how did you interpret it?
Well, from a personal view, I kind of found it funny because it's kind of this water cooler. It wants to be a kind of water cooler movie. As Steph says, it kind of touches on the kind of battle of the sexes aspect. And I kind of laughed when I was watching this movie. I did enjoy it, but I kind of laughed because I'm in a relationship where I'm basically not the breadwinner. So... Yeah. So I'm, you know, not being the breadwinner so much, but still earning a certain amount and having a family and whatnot, what happens in my world is I don't care. not in that way. Like this idea that that men have in their head, they have to be have these kind of weird hunter gatherers and all this stuff, and some of that stuff that you see on with people that are all, who are always online. Like I don't care. Like my thing is, are we earning enough? Are we paying our bills? Is my son all right? I don't really give a damn about some of this other stuff that's kind of going on there. Because most of the time, a lot of the people who are having these conversations aren't in the situations they seem to profess about. I don't think they are as bad as each other. I think one is worse because I think one is being really manipulative. And I will say he is clearly pushing certain buttons, and there's certain things that he does, certain websites that he's looking at and kind of red pilling himself through the movie, which is quite interesting. But I find it really interesting to see how quickly manipulated by power she becomes. I don't think there's a good or a bad guy. I think there's certain shades of grey throughout. And I think what's quite interesting is like he's kind of corrupted by what happens to him and his job and the internet and whatnot. And she seems to be kind of more corrupted by the power, the system, the fact that she's actually good at it. And someone's allowing her to actually kind of let loose. But we are, it's a capitalist system that turns around and kind of breeds psychopaths. It's constantly kind of said. So there is this element of her unleashing this kind of, not psychopathic, but this kind of really ruthless side to her. And that's what makes the film interesting to me.
I definitely agree with what you're saying in terms of her being, you know, corrupted by capitalism and hustle culture. I wouldn't necessarily view the film as her being particularly power hungry. I think, you know, she's a woman that has studied really hard, gone to an excellent university and worked hard to be where she is. And I feel like the scene towards the end where, I don't know really how much to say, but there's a scene where I suppose she sort of sends her partner down the river in a sense and maybe stoops to his level in a sense. I feel like she does that because she sees no way out. I feel like she's been so beaten down by the systems in place, by her relationship, by her workplace. And I feel like she's sort of forced into a bad decision because she feels like she has no other choice.
I mean, possibly, but I think there's just, I don't know. I think there's that element of catharsis just, I'm talking about the last seconds of the movie.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I'm just one, it's just something about the look on her face that, I don't know. I get the feeling that she's won in more sense of the word than anything else. I'm not entirely sure that she's so beaten down by the system because she's more than happy to kind of embrace it still. I could be completely wrong.
No, I don't think you're wrong at all. But, I mean, it's more coming to this film. And like, it's been, I've like had it like just stay with me for quite a while. Like, when I kind of go back and I reflect what this film was actually about, the stakes are incredibly low.
Very.
But yeah, I was like, I was watching it like it was like a Michael Mann, like thriller, like, you know, like there was something about like what Chloe Dorman does with like the composition, with the edit, with the structure, where I was just like, I was on the edge of my seat.
It's the tension. She wrings out tension from her two performers, and I think it's really, really interesting. I think that's really, really interesting. There's obviously the bit where, obviously, Emily gets the job, and Luke hugs her and goes, "I'm so happy for you." And you're waiting for the moment, and the moment is that they hug, and you look at Luke's face, and there's that kind of flicker of, "Well, what now?" But in a lesser film, it would be more pronounced. And in this, it's literally just a brief look on it, a really, really blink and you miss it look. And I think that's what I think the film is kind of really good at. I'm not sure if it's in the composition. I think compositions are quite tight and lots of mid shots, and I don't really get too much out of it. I think it was just the way she kind of extrapolates these just elements of tension from her, from the performance. I think she really kind of just nails it there. I'm kind of like, yeah, I don't know what it is, but you sit there going, so what happens next? And, oh, she's a bastard, or, oh my God, what's she doing? Like, there's just that element of it.
Is this hedge fund going to short this stock? Apparently, hasn't there, Garrett?
I think the tension comes not from who's going to, you know, who's going to get promoted? Is she going to lose their job? Are they going to break up? I think the tension comes from, oh no, what is he going to do to her? Because I think for him, being professionally cucked is even worse than getting, you know, actually cheated on by her. And I think what we, just to circle back on what we started talking about, and the sort of, when you were mentioning being red-pilled he's being red-pilled and things like that, you know, the incel element for me worked the best when he spends money he doesn't have on this seminar about how to improve his life. For me, that was when sort of the alarm bell started going. And that for me was the interesting part on what kind of brought it into the modern day.
Oh, there's nothing more that I love than like a kind of typical leading man playing a deeply pathetic figure. And I would love to see an Alden Ulrich and Alexander Skarsgård in Infinity Pool duo of like, we are the loser men who are weirdly hot going on a little road trip. But yes, let's get some scores on this. Steph, you want to go first? In anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect.
Sure. So in anticipation, I'm always here to watch and support a female-directed erotic thriller. I have logged on. I'm ready. I'm giving it a 4 in anticipation. I'm very excited. And I really liked Phoebe Dunaver's performance of Bridgerton. I'm not so familiar with Alden Ehrenreich, but I was sort of very looking forward to it. So yeah, 4 in anticipation. In enjoyment, I think possibly a 3, because as much as I appreciated the conversations it was having, I wish it was done in a way that had a bit more, you know, we can talk about serious topics, but if you want to lean into these genre elements, make it a bit more fun, make it a bit more visually interesting, pick up the pace. I don't think it needed to be 2 hours personally. And then in retrospect, I think a 3 as well for me. You know, it's a very interesting piece of work, but I don't see it as one that's going to stay with me, and one that sort of earns its runtime. And as you said, Leila, I think it's quite thin on the ground in terms of plot and in terms of stakes. And I think that kind of kneecaps it in the end.
Yeah, I know people are very upset often when Festival Darlings end up on Netflix, but I gotta say, this seems about right. Leslie, what about you? What are your scores in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
Anticipation, 2. I didn't know what to expect, so I was kind of treading water with it at first. I wasn't entirely sure. I just really didn't know what to expect, so I kind of went into it as dark as possible. Enjoyment, I would say 3. I kind of agree with a lot of Steph there. It doesn't have to be as long as it is. I think from a personal level, it's really interesting drama, but it needs to be sexier if it wants to be an erotic thriller, and I don't think it is. And I think there's 2 moments with sexual aspects that are, one's quite interesting at the start, the other one is, I think we see it too much in movies, and I think it's part of a conversation I think a lot of people are having anyway, and I think it's not sexy. Like, that's the thing. It's an action of power.
I genuinely don't know what you're talking about, but like, all I can think of when I think of like the sex scenes in this film is just like, this is a female director who still doesn't seem to know how periods work.
God, they're explosive, aren't
they? They're explosive. They just, it's like you sneeze and it's like...
It was like The Shining corridor. I didn't know what I was watching.
Well, you know, God bless her if that's what that happens to her every lunar cycle. But next up, it's The Exorcist Believer.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
The parents of a pair of demonically possessed girls are desperate for help and search for the only person alive who has had a similar experience. Not a spoiler to say, the person with a similar experience is Ellen Burstyn, who was in the original Exorcist, which is now 50 years old. You know, the late, great William Friedkin, like, you know, was often, I think, undervalued as a director, having made, like, that classic film. Leslie, I guess I'll start with you. Like, what's your relationship with the original Exorcist? I've got a tale, but I'll let you start.
Like so many people, it was one of those films that scared me for years. It scared me before I even watched it. It was because it was had such a dodgy kind of. It was barred from like UK release for so long until 99, when I actually kind of. It was one of my first DVDs that I bought, and I watched it, and I was truly thrilled. Really enjoyed it. I really like the book as well, and I like Blatty's film work in general. I personally say that The Exorcist, The Ninth Configuration, and The Exorcist III Legion are the kind of real trilogy.
And, wait, it's in the books?
The books and the film, sorry, I apologise. And I really, really got on board with the idea of someone like David Gordon Green doing it, because I think it's one of those things on where I think there is something to be mined from some of the material. Unfortunately, this doesn't live up to it. It is an absolute dog's dinner. It's really bad. Like, god-awful. So much so, I'm kind of lost for words.
I mean, I'm not even with you that, like, I think the Exorcist book was bad. And I think, as a result, the Exorcist film, 50 years old, rest in peace, William Friedkin, you were a genius, is a miracle. And this is, I mean, I don't want to say
like I
that. I don't want to wish, if there's anything to comfort yourself with the fact of William Friedkin's untimely death, it's that maybe he didn't see this.
Yeah, I think he timed it perfectly. And I feel like I should point out that I bumped into the lovely Leslie at the screening, and we ended up sitting next to each other to watch this film. And the film itself was bad, but I felt like I should just give it an extra star rating, because out of the corner of my eye, every time Ellen Burstyn came on screen, Leslie sort of did this very confused hand gesture of why is she here, and why do they keep cutting back to her, which made me laugh. It was very funny.
It was, I zoned out because this is a massive cosplay. I just felt this was just a cosplay machine. They do things in it. They lift so much from visually from the original film, but they don't understand why it's in the original film. So I just found it utterly frustrating. And one reason is Ellen Burstyn being so good in the original movie. The story about her coming back for this movie is told. It's online. Have a look. It's a good story. But she's so wasted. And one of the things that really annoyed me is to have her kind of come on and say, I wasn't allowed into the original exorcism because of the patriarchy.
People died, lady.
They saved your kid.
But it's not just that. Like, for me, that what really annoys me about that is just, I remember at the screening, there was this kind of weird kind of cheer and like, yeah, right on sort of thing. And I was like, okay. And then we progressed to watch the very male filmmakers turn around and just waste this character all the way through. And it was just dreadful. Like, it was absolutely dreadful. And I found myself really frustrated. And the reason why I was frustrated, because it was, it kind of put that idea of patriarchy in there to go, look, we're talking to you guys. Yeah, we're winking at the camera. Look at what we're talking about. And then they proceed to just waste the female character in there. They waste most of the female characters in there. You've got Anne Dowd in there. If you're going to have a movie about possession or grief or anything, and you've got Anne Dowd in there, come on, you can't just waste it in this kind of needless part. I thought, I just found myself so irritated.
I'm a Hamilton stan, so like actually just having Leslie Odom Jr. in here and like not taking the opportunity to have an Exorcism based musical number, total fucking waste. So sorry, you were saying?
I feel like we just have to talk more about Ellen Burstyn and the fact that the sort of explanation they give is that after the events, because this is a legacy sequel, a word I hate and a concept I also hate. But the explanation they give of sort of what happened between the events of the first film and now is that she wrote a book about her experiences with her daughter Reagan, a book called A Mother's Explanation, rubbish title. She writes this book and her daughter is sort of like, Mom, I can't believe you wrote this book about my life. And then they're sort of estranged. And that's sort of the emotional setting of Ellen Burstyn's current life.
Again, and younger then, lady, people died.
Yeah. I mean, it's just wild. And then I kind of don't want to ruin the scene because it's a terrible scene, but it's the one moment of sort of light comic relief in and amongst all of the other rubbish stuff. But in order to sort of keep Ellen Burstyn away from the action, presumably because she only signed on to do a certain number of days and because of her age, in order to keep her away, they just attack her very brutally and confine her to a hospital. And then to remind the audience that she's still a character, they just cut back to her at the most random moments in her bed with the bandages on her face. I suppose telepathically knowing what's happening at the exorcism that's happening down the road. It's just so bizarre. Such a bizarre use of the character, as Leslie said.
And to be fair, like, of all the injuries a person could have, no spoilers, it's not one that you come back from in terms of, like, what that does.
Oh, no, that lady's done.
she's finished, yeah.
But I did think it was very interesting about how, like, essentially in the first film, which, you know, like, 1973, we're kind of, like, looking, you know, 69 is the Manson murders, kind of, like, there's a lot of, like, the early brewing of the satanic panic happening. This was a controversial, you know, film with the church originally. And, you know, we do have in the original, you know, like, a young girl on the cusp of womanhood, like stabbing herself, essentially masturbating, stabbing herself, however you want to, like, is it in her private parts with a crucifix. And then in this film, it's more like enacting hideous violence on another person. But I was watching that because, like, there is that kind of reference of, like, what happens when a demonic girl gets her hands on a crucifix. And I did feel that, like, 2023, you can't go there. You can't have a girl kind of doing what Friedkin had someone do back then.
I agree. I think Friedkin kind of looked at the material, wondered what he could get away with, and did it really well. I think I think you were right earlier saying he was undervalued, because I think he really did push boundaries where he could. I mean, he does it in Cruising, and he definitely does it in The Exorcist. And I think by pushing those boundaries, he kind of put forth a kind of moral question to the audience. Depending on what version you see of The Exorcist, he kind of turns up and goes, oh, well, it's the ultimate struggle between good and evil, like in intros and whatnot. And I kind of get that. And it's like, that is so, what she does is so kind of horrific. And I think we're kind of now in this as a society, well, in terms of cinema, we kind of move away from that. We're kind of cleansing ourselves away from that, so to speak. And again, this is one of the reasons I found myself really frustrated. At one point, a character, Leslie Odell's character, is basically asked to choose between his wife and his daughter. And the thing that I think what irritated me the most is, having personally gone through tragic events and looking at stuff like that, I was like, well, how are you going to do this? What are you going to do in order to kind of give me that weight and give me that kind of emotional pull? I know it's a horror movie, and I know it's, you know, we don't kind of look at horror movies in the same way as, say, The Exorcist now, but what are you going to do? And it doesn't do anything with it. It just really just makes everything kind of go flat, and it's really kind of pathetically done. And I was just like, well, this is it, isn't it? It's not, if you're going to make this, if you're going to have a kind of moral quandary, you got to do something to make me kind of look up and realize and grab me by the freaking testicles or anything. And it doesn't do anything. It's just a naff film in that way. And like I said, I think it's just it's a cosplay machine. It turns around and mimics the shots of everything, but it doesn't even know why it's called The Exorcist. It doesn't understand why it's called The Exorcist.
There's no danger, there's no shock, there's no surprise. It's rehashed cliches from the first film. They don't even have the creative verve to come up with their own iconic moments. They eventually recreate the head turning and things like that. But, you know, why include that to make us point at the screen and clap like monkeys and say, oh, we remember you doing that in the first film? Like, no, give us something new. Prove your reason for existing. If the only reason you're remaking this film is because you have the idea of, oh, what if two girls were possessed instead of one? Like, no, that's not enough.
But also, despite being different races, what if they turn the same hue?
There's so much set dressing like that. As you said, Leslie, you know, the comment about Ellen Burstyn's character saying, I wasn't allowed in the room because of the patriarchy. And then, you know, there's lots of threads that begin that don't end, like the microaggressions from the white parents towards Leslie Odom Jr.'s character. You know, we didn't know our daughter was friends with your daughter. Like, all of these things are sort of peppered throughout, but to sort of no end. It's a film of half-assed attempts.
It's a film of references. It's a film, yeah. And I think it's one of the biggest problems I think we have with a lot of film. This is why we don't call it content, because what happens with content, it just becomes references and memes and nothing else. It just is. So you can turn around and point and go, I know where this is from. And that's the worst thing.
It's almost like the thing that we once loved was possessed by something nefarious and evil. Leslie, do you want to do your scores in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
So in anticipation, give it 3, because I'm always kind of interested to see what we can do with a horror movie. Always kind of interesting to see what we can do with a remake. You know, big fan of The Thing, so to speak. Big fan of Let Me In as well. But enjoyment, I'll give it a 1. I kind of went in, and after I realised that it was just playing the reference game, I got very, very bored very, very quickly. It's ladenly paced, and it doesn't seem to know what it's doing with itself. And if you're going to do a race swap, at least, you know, be interesting with that. And then for actual verdict, I'll give it a 1.
Steph, what about you?
I think in anticipation, I would give it a 3. You know, I've not seen any good legacy sequels. I don't particularly enjoy the Halloween trilogy, although I do think that those films are better than this one, if we're talking about David Gordon Green's attempts at doing this kind of thing. In enjoyment, it was a 2. I think the reason why I assume most people listening will love the original Exorcist. I think the reason so many of us love that film is because of how visceral it is. You can see the lumps in the pea soup vomit. You can, you know, really feel these practical effects, and they're scary, they're horrible. And with this, just, it was dark, it was dank, it was poorly lit. The effects were naff. It was just, there was no joy in watching what was happening. And also, it just wasn't scary. It wasn't scary at all, which was very disappointing. And then in retrospect, I wouldn't say 1, because I feel like 1 is very much burn all copies. And I did think Leslie Odom Jr. was doing fine work given the material. You know, he's a very solid actor, and
he was doing
the best he could.
He is good.
Bless him, he was doing the best he could. So I think, yeah, in retrospect too.
Yeah, if Fair Play was 3.5s above the board, I think this is like 1.5s across the board. The thing that I will say that, like, it really did give to me was I ended up spending a huge amount of time in the car with my daughter today, who's 7, and I answer every question she gives me, and there's been a lot of Exorcist believer buses going, and she asked me what The Exorcist was, and I was just like, well, this was a, you know, a horror film 50 years ago, and like, she's asking me what it was about, and I was like, it was scary, and she was like, well, what happens? And I was like, well, something bad gets into a little girl, but don't worry, that can't happen to you. And she was like, well, what does she kill people? What does she do? And I was like, no, she's mostly in bed. She throws up on one point. Yeah, like, and like explaining The Exorcist to her was a bit, made me like realize the magic of like, of what a miracle that first one is. Like, how, like, I couldn't believe that the sort of thing that I was plainly speaking out, obviously in like kind of vaguely child-friendly terms to her, was one of the most terrifying things I'd ever seen and like one of the most formative cinema experiences I've ever seen. So actually, maybe I changed my mind. One's across the board. Like, but you take that.
Woof.
It's a primal. The original's a primal movie.
I think of the line in it of like the point is to make you despair, and maybe that's apt here because that's what this did. But at least our thrills are about to get a little bit sexier, or are they? Because next up it's Film Club with Disclosure. Tom Sanders is a senior executive at a tech company on the verge of releasing an innovative new product. Success is assured until a vamp from his past, Meredith Johnson, swoops in, stealing his impending promotion and then suing him for sexual harassment. Steph, this is the most bitches be cray film I have ever seen in my entire life. And I very rarely get to choose Film Club, but I had seen this not that long ago and I was like, I need to talk about this with someone.
Thank you for your service. Yeah, what to say? I have seen this film before, but honestly, rewatching it last week with my boyfriend, we had some drinks, we put it on, he'd not seen it. Genuinely one of the best bonding moments we've ever had because we were laughing like no tomorrow, and that, my friends, is entertainment. No, but in all seriousness, yes, it's not a very good film. But I think it's important to situate it. Obviously, it's a 90s erotic thriller, but I think you had Fatal Attraction in the late 80s, which was tapping into the cultural context. But then in sort of 1991, you had the first publicised, very well publicised sexual harassment case. You had the Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas case. And, you know, Anita Hill with this very beautiful young woman, very successful lawyer, and the whole world saw her being questioned by this all-white, all-male judiciary committee asking her insane questions about pubic hair on Coke cans and all sorts for the world to see. And I think that was really the first, you know, public case of sexual harassment in the workplace. And from then, you did get films like Disclosure. You got films like The Temp, you know, a very crazy erotic thriller with Timothy Hutton and Laura Flynn Boyle about the temp from hell. Leslie is laughing because I know he's thinking, oh God, don't talk about the temp. But so after the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas case, you had the next year, this big boom of women being voted into the House of Representatives. You had more women being elected to the Senate. And I think around this time, 1991, 1992, and then we get Disclosure a couple of years later, there's a big focus in society and by proxy in erotic thrillers about sexual harassment, the workplace. Can women have it all? Can they be successful? Can they have a sex life? Can they be autonomous? Can they subdue men? And this film attempts to do something with this cultural soup that it found itself as the fly swimming in. Is it successful? Who knows? But I'm glad it exists.
I'm genuinely glad it exists. It's an absolute riot. I'm very glad I'm not part of a culture of which it is like defining anything. Leslie, I've got to assume this is not your first time to Disclosure.
I think I've watched Disclosure 3 times, so yeah, I'm glutton for punishment. It's a weird one, isn't it? I can't remember what I read. Oh, there was something about Crichton, I think, saying he swapped the gender roles because there was things that once you swap the gender roles and have a man be kind of sexually harassed, you could kind of bring more talking points, or there was something along those lines that he kind of mentioned. And no, I'm sorry. Maybe I need to read the book, but no. And I think the reason why is just simply because instead, like, I think this is where Fair Play plays really well, where instead of having any kind of shades of grey, Demi Moore is just straight up a bad guy. They've taken all these kind of things from what you would expect a man to do, and just kind of staple them onto this onto a woman, a female character, and it just feels so wrong. And it feels wrong in this kind of irritating, short-sighted way. There's no complexity, even though Moore does really well with terrible material. Like, she's good. She looks good. She kind of walks with a stride. It could have been really interesting to see her kind of play and manipulate certain things, but she isn't. It's really, really thin on the ground. It's really thin gruel. And it's really irritating. And Enrico Marconi's score was just awful. I'm sorry.
Oh, God. Maybe his worst.
This is a master scorist, a master musician. And he phoned it in. I'm sorry. He really did. It really, really bad. And Michael Douglas doesn't enlist any kind of sympathy. One of the things I like about him in Basic Instinct and The Fatal Attraction is that he's a little bit guilty. He's always a little bit. He always looks a little bit guilty. And what he does is very guilty. In Basic Instinct, you know, he's supposed to be a hero, but he's an arsehole. He's a dumbass. I like that.
Wait, some people think that Michael Douglas is a hero in Basic Instinct?
I think so. I think so.
Do we need to do an extra podcast on this?
Come on. We might have to, because I've gone over too long anyway. There's something a little nasty about him in those movies, and they kind of try and cleanse it all here, and it's awful. It's dreadful. I don't buy him as this kind of family man who once had a Roman eye sort of thing, but now it's all okay and everything, and it just looked silly. And I think it's interesting after watching something like Oppenheimer, where again you have this kind of disposition, which all this sexual exploits kind of laid bare. And then you watch this and it's like, okay, yeah, what were we doing in the 90s? Why are we doing this so badly? I just found it really, really, really bad. And then the virtual reality scene is incredible.
Oh, my God. I just think more films should have their plot climax with Meredith Johnson, Demi Moore's character, coming towards them in a VR filing cabinet whilst Ennio Morricone's score goes it's truly wild.
It's like the Lawnmower Man. It's amazing. Just great to see.
I used to kind of like believe that like all films should kind of end with a musical number. And now, yes, Steph, I'm converted that is how film should end.
I just think it's a really funny film to watch in the present day. Obviously, completely agree with Leslie. There's something rotting in the state of Denmark. There's like something truly evil that lives in this film. It's bad faith in all of the ways that a film can be bad faith. But, and yet, for my sins, it's just, it's gloriously ludicrous, you know. When Michael Douglas, who we all know is just that guy, when he stands there and he says, why don't I be that guy, that white evil male you're all complaining about? And I'm like, hello, you are. and all of the really dated techno babble and how he's messed up the production line of Digicom's CD-ROM. And it's just so hilariously 1992, I can't remember the exact year that was made.
94.
It's so specific, 94. It's so specifically that year. You know, it's just amazing.
You couldn't do CD-ROMs in 95. You definitely couldn't do it in 93. It has to be 94.
I do love that, like, we do think of Michael Douglas as having been in a million erotic thrillers. It's just the three. Yeah. It's just Basic Instinct, Fatal Attraction, and this one.
I would advocate for A Perfect Murder, which is a remake of Dial M for Murder, I believe. And it is, I think, an erotic thriller.
I don't think it's that. Okay, we'll debate. Okay, 3.5 erotic thrillers we'll agree on.
I'll take that.
It's got, I will say, it's got one line that I had to laugh because it's so pointedly obvious of what it's about. It's like, this is America. The legal system is supposed to protect people like me. And it's like the most richest man. It's Donald Sutherland at that point, like the most richest man. I'm like, that's...
Indeed that's it is, wealthy white hilarious. Man. That's literally how it was structured.
Oh, God, what about when Michael Douglas has a nightmare that he's kissing Donald Sutherland, and the camera zooms you into Donald Sutherland's mouth as it's like gaping open. It's truly just
the best. I was like, we've lost something as a culture.
I feel really bad because Demi Moore turns up in two films that we've done at Fatal Attraction. She turns up in this and Indecent Proposal. They're clearly aimed at being these kind of water cooler moment type movies, and they're both really dull. They're just not very interesting.
Yeah, Indecent Proposal is so much more boring than people think it is.
It's really long. Mm-hmm. It's really long.
Very long.
So,
what a bad ending! Like an auction for a hippo.
I will say, yes, it wasn't an erotic thriller in that way, but we kind of lean on these kind of weird yuppie movies as well. And we've also done Species, so therefore we kind of have a very...
I write hard for Species. I will not see that being like, people overhyping Indecent Proposal and sleeping on Species.
Exactly.
Just so we're not completely shitting on Demi Moore, I do want to advocate for the very good 90s film by Alan Rudolph, Mortal Thoughts, which she's in. She is in some good, sexy-ish 90s films. Mortal Thoughts is a banger. Harvey Keitel, Bruce Willis.
I think she's good in this. I think she's okay in Indecent Proposal. And I think she's very, very sexy. And I think that's really, really cool. It's just that her character is
I think she's a talented actress, but in my heart of hearts, the thing that she's done that I loved the most was like her Instagram content during the pandemic, where she like gathered all of her extended family in what was the weirdest looking house, which is like a ranch in like, I want to say Montana. And there was just like, I mean, it has to seem to be believed. There's sort of like a lot of statues of armors and carpeted bathrooms and people doing like oil painting classes. Anyway, God bless you, Demi Moore.
Yes.
The world is a better place for having you in it.
Oh, captain, my captain.
Agree.
But yeah, we should wrap up now, but we've got our one last thing. So, Leslie, what are you going to recommend to people that is not a movie to seek out this week?
If you did like Fair Play, or you're interested in something like Fair Play, I really recommend Industry. It's quite sexy. It's quite, you know, it might fill a hole where Succession is now ended.
Ooh my.
Maybe it's not as good as Succession, but it may fill that hole in terms of...
Stop talking about filling a hole, Leslie.
Why have you got me on here? You know, I'm going to put my foot in my mouth by saying, you know, by making double entendres. Industry.
What can we have our holes filled by again? Please continue.
Industry, just watch Industry.
Sorry, I need to stop. I will just go down a terrible path of puns. Like, Steph, what would you recommend?
Well, it is a semi-related to movie recommendation, but it is a book. I've just finished a book called Brian by Jeremy Cooper. And it's a really great book. It's by Fitzcarraldo, published by Fitzcarraldo, and it's about this guy who's quite lonely and has poor social skills, who decides to go to the BFI one day and eventually finds this group of cinephiles that he finally feels like he belongs with, and how he decides from that day on to spend 7 days a week at the BFI. And it's a very touching ode to cinema going and community and being an outsider and finding your people. And I just thought it was very beautiful. So yeah, I would recommend that book.
God, this is like how kind of tainted I am by your thing of like, my first thought with that after you speaking, Leslie, it was just like, so would you say that the BFI fills a hole?
Why am I on here?
No, Jenny, thank you, Steph. I mean, like, I think that's so important. I've always been like a person that like went to the cinema by myself. I didn't think of it as a community. Mm-hmm. It was like, it was something just like for me to go out and connect with the world. And I don't know why people wait for someone to be free to go out and kind of seek out a movie. Like, the movie is the person you're hanging out with.
Yeah, going to the cinema on my own is my favourite thing. And if I do go with other people, or if I'm at a festival, I just don't want to be asked about what I've just seen. Give me at least 10 minutes and a coffee and then maybe we can chat about it. I want to soak it all in.
Yes, and you were very kind to me one time after I came out of Bones and All, and I was like in a near catatonic state of tears. It was very early, to be fair, and I'd slept very little. And you looked at me and I was just shaking. You were just like, okay, we'll give it some time.
I thought, I'm going to walk away and I'll talk to you later.
Very grateful. I needed the space. So if you've got thoughts on these films, you can email Truth and Movies at CCO London or tweet us at LW Lies. Next week, it's all Scorsese all the time, and we take a look at Killers of the Flower Moon and reflect back on his legacy. Thank you very much for tuning in. And if you enjoy the show, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcast. Truth Movies is hosted by me, Leila Latif, and my guests this week were Leslie Pitt and Seth Green. Podcast is hosted by TCO London and edited by Bob Stankers.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.